all you knew was that for that 3 minutes that he was okay and he was talking and he was gonna be all right.
The news stations were all filming in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they were putting all the lots of segments up on the news, or almost it was going round the clock. And my two daughters and myself would just sit. We sat the entire day, hoping possibly to get a glimpse of him, just a glimpse.
You know, I was able to handle all of my affairs easily. You know, I was always a top performer. I was always a top guy. I was always, you know, at the forefront of things before I went to Iraq. And then when I got back from Iraq, I was, you know, barely functional.
It's just, I'm a totally different person than I was before I went and come back.
It's pretty difficult to get a man that is mute to describe to you what it's like not being able to speak.
I believe it's important to address this topic because it's happening to more people than are realized.
There's more people that are killing themselves now than are dying in combat.
I have very, very vague or no recollection of this, but what they tell me is that I was very violent. I was very irritable. I didn't talk really to anybody for the first several months that I was back, the first 5 or 6 months. You know, there were a lot of violent outbursts, a lot of instances where I smashed things and furniture and windows and doors and got in fights with people, instances of road rage.
I didn't think I had issues. I thought my reaction was normal. It was just who I was. My anger and my stress and my inability to cope with everyday issues. And they sat down and basically told me that they thought that I had PTSD.
Post-traumatic stress disorder is a mental disorder that results from a psychologically traumatic event. There are 4 different categories of symptoms in PTSD. I think the most important ones are called re-experiencing, and that consists of reliving the traumatic event in your mind after it's over. People sometimes come back from war and they think, thank God, I don't have to go through that again, it's over, I'm going to go home and live a normal life. And unfortunately, they have bad dreams about the event. They think about it during the daytime, they have daydreams. If something reminds them of it in some way, it will trigger a memory.
Terrible sleep problems, nightmares that are so real that I've woken up with the smell of something still in the air or a sound, and go from hearing a full-on scream in my sleep and waking up and still hearing it echo. We'll be right back.
time.
There are times where all I can do is concentrate in my mind on keeping myself grounded in one location and not what I call lose the bubble. And that is absolute situational awareness, controlling my heartbeat, controlling my breathing, controlling my racing thoughts that are going in directions that I don't necessarily control. And I find myself in that 1,000-yard stare when I am focused on maintaining my bubble. When you lose the bubble, that's where people die. That's the end of the road.
I had no sense of belonging. It was self-medication helped me cope with the fact of separating from the military. No one gives you a magic pill. Okay, turn off everything that you learned, all your behaviors that you contracted while you were in the military. I had a hard time adapting, self-medication through drugs and alcohol. Always the life of the party. But when the party was over, I was a recluse. I didn't, you know, very little socialization. It was years after I had separated from the military, I was driving down a highway in Florida and thought I was having a heart attack. I thought I was going to die. And got into the hospital and they ran every test, poked and prodded, and told me that I just had severe anxiety and started asking me about my background and some of my life experiences and put me in contact with different counselors, and they told me that I had post-traumatic stress disorder.
PTSD is, like I said, a traumatic experiences. Symptoms, minor symptoms are depression, anxiety. I thought I'd been on dying of a heart attack several times, been in the hospital, been have tests run on me. You have uncontrollable moods, anger, rage, crying spells, worthlessness. It goes hand in hand for me with depression. I face it every day. I face it every night I go to sleep, I try to sleep. I face it every morning I wake up. The phone rings, I don't want to answer it. If somebody knocks on my door, do I want to answer the door or do I want to knock their lights out?
So the second category of symptoms are avoidance symptoms. If a person with PTSD finds it upsetting to be reminded about the traumatic events, they will avoid anything that might remind them of it. If they have a combat-related event, they may not watch television, they may not see news stories about what's going on in Iraq or Afghanistan.
I lived in on Long Island in Hicksville, and not far from a train station. It sounded like a machine gun racking, and I had that exact reaction. Many times I would see, especially driving, you know, see something on the side of the road or hear something, and I would swerve like, I thought it was an IED.
I spent 6 years in an apartment, just go to work, go home, locking myself in because the outside world was much, much scarier than the confines of my cave.
Sadness is what I feel, but my default feeling is aggression. If you make me sad, I'll get aggressive. If you insult me, I'll get aggressive. Sometimes you don't have to do any of that and I'll get aggressive. So I'm walking around constantly maintaining that. I know what I'm supposed to do. I know how a normal human functions. I'm very aware of what normal should look like. So I act every day. I act normal. Nothing like how I feel.
The third set of criteria are what are called emotional numbing. And what that basically means is that people with PTSD have trouble getting emotionally involved in the present. They're living in the past. Their emotions are in the past. So they have trouble feeling the normal feelings of love or attachment or interest. in things that they used to enjoy. And then the fourth category of symptoms we call hyperarousal, and that's basically being overly nervous. It includes such things as having trouble sleeping, difficulty concentrating, being overly watchful or on guard for bad things to happen.
The first time I tried to commit suicide was 6 months after I got back from Iraq. The helplessness, the loneliness, no one could understand. My friends talking about, you went over there and you did nothing. Still the same mess. It's all about the oil, all about the oil, all about the oil. It just builds up. And it cost me my marriage.
So trying to cope with being afflicted with post-traumatic stress disorder in a society that doesn't understand, it's devastating. Absolutely devastating.
Everybody has suffered as a result of, my reaction to how I react to them, because, their lives haven't changed. They didn't go to Iraq. They were not in, intense combat. It's me that's changed, and they remember what I was like before, and now they see what I'm like now. And my wife used to say, who are you?
There's hundreds of thousands of troops returning from this conflict, from this war, but there are millions that may not even know that this is what has been destroying their life.
We tend to say that people either have or don't have PTSD because we want to treat it like another medical disorder. You either have or don't have appendicitis. You either have or don't have typhoid fever. But in medicine, there actually are some disorders that you don't really have or not have. There's like a degree, like high blood pressure, for example. There's no magic cutoff when a person has high blood pressure versus they don't. It's just the higher the blood pressure is, the more affected they are. That's probably what applies to post-traumatic stress disorder also. It's not an either or, it's more or less a continuum or a degree. And people can have varying amounts of symptoms after a traumatic event, from none to a huge number.
Depression, sleep issues, anxiety, chronic pain, phantom pain, memory problems, issues with concentration, anger, overwhelming sadness, inability to communicate, scattered thoughts, unable to focus, unable to think down the road more than right here. It's everywhere you never wanted to go. And your mind turns into a bad, bad neighborhood, nowhere you'd want to be, and there's no way to move out.
After having family members in probably all the wars, I had my grandfather was in World War I, my uncles were in World War II, my father was in the Korean conflict, my cousin was in Vietnam. I dreaded wars. I mean, nothing good comes out of it. There's destruction, death, and casualties in both sides.
John enlisted much to my dismay. I was not happy about it. I tried to discourage him. I tried to forbid him.
I was the youngest of four, and we were all planning on going to college. And by the time it came to John, he knew that the money was running out. And that it was just, you know, both of us were going to be going, and he'd be going ahead of me. He was looking at private schools, and they were going to be expensive.
You know, at the time, it was, you know, I was happy for him. I was pretty excited. It was before, you know, we knew how things were going to turn out. Yeah, I don't think anybody realized where we were going to go, you know, militarily. So at the time, it was just, I was happy, you know, college would be paid for. It'd be good to get some discipline out of it, you know, boot camp, you know, toughen you up type of thing.
You know, I definitely don't think he meant to put us through anything, and I don't think it was anything that he chose that led to all of this, because he did something brave and wonderful by joining the military and serving his country and community in this way.
I remember thinking that I am joining the ranks of millions of people before me who have sent a loved one to war, and I didn't want to join those ranks. I did not want my baby boy going to war, and yet he did.
I said to one person, you know, this is awful, my brother's in Iraq, I'm really having a hard time, and they kind of had this, you know, tough, quick response, well, he joined the military, what do you expect? You know, and I mean, yeah, he did, and I was so proud of him that he did, but it didn't make it any easier for any of us. And it didn't change the fact that he may not come home.
After 14 months, I came home. My mom was like, oh, let's go get something to eat. I was like, I just want to go home. And we went to this restaurant in the town I grew up in, and I was like, I was really uncomfortable in there because I was in uniform. You know, I was in you know, the desert fatigues that we were wearing, and everybody's looking, and at the time, I wasn't sure if it was like a sense of pride or if it was more like, oh God, I wouldn't want my kid in that situation, but I didn't want to be there. I didn't want to be in this restaurant, in this open space with a bunch of people that I didn't know, you know, wearing this uniform that I was so proud of, but I was the only one wearing it in this restaurant where everybody else was wearing different stuff, and that's not what I was used to overseas. Everybody wore the same thing, everybody. And I just wanted to kind of get home where I felt it was safe and secure.
And I think that once John came back, our relationship is still great, and you know, all of my friends and people who see my family often say, oh, you guys are so close, you know, we're jealous, or things like that. And that still definitely exists, but I think John's more closed off. You know, he doesn't want to talk about certain things, and not even related to the military, but just things that are stressful or, you know, really important. Sometimes he'll just, you know, shut you down. Like, nope, I'm not gonna talk about this now. Or he won't necessarily hide, but kind of like, you know, not be around for a couple days or not answer your calls certain times. And that's, I think, what's really different from before.
I remember driving with him and he would be afraid. He would shake. I remember being in his car. He came home and he bought a car, and he was driving his car, and I was the passenger, and we were going out to dinner, just the two of us, and he started to shake, and he said, when I see a bright light on the side, from the side, it could be anything. It could be the sun reflecting off of something, or it would make him panic.
I think even when he returned home, he was so hyper-vigilant. He was more interested in the people around him and whether or not they were going to pull out a weapon, you know, sitting in a lecture hall full of 500 people, or whether or not somebody was going to walk in the room and do something to him.
And I came home and I was like, oh my God, how am I going to transition back into this, you know, back in here? And I was like, get me away. Like, get me back to the guys that I've been with for so long. You know, the last almost 2 years. Get me back with those guys, because they understand. You know, they understand like that. You know, the heightened awareness, and they understand the hypervigilance, and they understand, you know, the uneasiness, and you know, we're always scanning, we're always looking for the next threat, the next target, and it's like people don't get that here. And I didn't like it. And I came home, and you know, every morning my mom would want to come in my room and just see me in my bed, and just, you know, just know that I'm there. And I remember one morning she came in, and somehow I slept through the door opening, and she touched me, and I jumped up, and I just lurched at her, and I had no idea what I was doing until I was already in full swing. And when I noticed it was her, I stopped, and I was like, holy shit. It's not who I am. This is my mom. I love her more than anybody on this planet. Like, what's going on?
And you'd have a normal conversation, and then all of a sudden, he would just become very angry, and you really wouldn't know what set him off. At that point in time, I was telling my other children that we have to give him space. I mean, I lived this once before with my own father, and you just have to give him space, and hopefully we can get him whatever help that he might need. But the tough part about it is John and I sat down one day, and I said, listen, I'm not trying to upset you, but we need to talk. I don't know what you fully went through, but if you talk to me, maybe I can help you get through it. John looked at me. He was upset, and he said, you would not know what I went through because you were never at war.
Many veterans feel that other people really cannot understand them unless they've been in the same situation themselves. And that, you know, that's partially true. As a psychiatrist, I never was in a combat situation, but I have spoken to hundreds or thousands of combat veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, and by listening to them, I've come to understand a lot about it. If a veteran thinks I don't understand and I can't understand, then part of the therapeutic process may be for me to say, well, you help me understand by you telling me about it yourself.
I always know when John is having a hard time because he stops talking to me. Whether or not it's for a day and he's avoiding my calls, or weeks, I mean, it's been months at certain points. And he pushes away anybody that's really close to him, and he'll start reaching out to strangers. So when he first came home, he would have a hard time talking to us, you know, not even necessarily about his service, but just talking to us in general. And couldn't be near us physically, like, you know, trying to give him a hug, you know, because he just came home. We haven't seen him for 14 months, and he would be really uncomfortable. And that didn't change for a long, long time. And he would reach out for people that he didn't even talk to in high school. And all of a sudden, these people are now his new best friend for the day.
And he wasn't home that long that we noticed that he was quieter. He was never quiet, and he was quieter and more moody, and either sleeping all the time or not sleeping at all. He would go through these phases, and I remember he went to a Celtics game or a Bruins game, and he said he was on the tee, and there was a loud noise. And he and his friend Ben were there together, and they fell to the floor on the tee, which kind of shocked people because they were the first ones to go and they were some of the first to return. So it was all new to have these soldiers returning. The people in this country didn't have experience with many soldiers coming back at that point. It was really relatively new.
I had this weight on my shoulders that I didn't know how to deal with, and I didn't realize that when we did go out to eat, I felt uncomfortable having my back to the door. I felt uncomfortable being in the middle of the room because it felt like a vulnerable spot for me. I didn't feel right walking through an open space or walking through a crowded space. You know, these are all things that in my mind just weren't okay. And I had no one watching my, I felt like there was no one watching my back at this point. There was no one that I trusted that had their eyes open, that were scanning the crowd like I was. And for some reason, that just took a toll on me, and it continued to get worse and worse and worse as I didn't acknowledge it. And I, you know, my family, you know, I think they were afraid to tell me, like, hey, maybe you should just go get checked out. Plus I was having all these headaches, and I just tried to deal with those and suppress that. And I didn't want to tell my family that I got injured while I was there, and my vision was blurry, and sometimes I couldn't taste. And my head hurt so bad that I just wanted to throw up. I didn't want to get into that.
It was difficult. He was in the hospital. It was frightening. He was 20 years old, and he'd had a stroke. And one side of his face was drooping, and he was on a lot of monitors, and he was being evaluated. They were telling us that his blood pressure was so high, and he's thin, and he's tall, and he's in great shape, that he had cardiomegaly. His heart was enlarged from having blood pressure too high for so long. So we learned a lot of things while he was hospitalized that we had not had any knowledge of prior to that.
I was kind of upset with the whole VA medical center. I mean, the doctors were very caring. They seemed to be very compassionate. But once we were instructed that John had the stroke, they asked us, do you have any concerns? And they told us about the testing that was going to take place. And one of the tests that John was going to receive was a CAT scan. And at the end of the day, when they came back and to check on him again, they asked me if I had any questions. And I asked them at that point in time, what time today are you going to be doing the CAT scan? And I was informed that they couldn't bring in anyone to do the CAT scan because they couldn't approve the overtime. And I was beside myself. So they reassured me that he was stable and everything was going to be fine. They just needed to conclude some more testing. The next day, I was sitting at John's bedside. The doctors again arrived during grand rounds. After they examined him, asked me if I had any questions, and I said yes. I said, what time today are you going to be performing the CAT scan? And one of the physicians looked at me and said, today's President's Day, so we can't authorize the overtime for the CAT scan. We'll have to wait till tomorrow. At that point in time, I just looked at these four physicians and I said, I know my son has a fulfillment with the U.S. government that he can't sue you. If something happens to my son because of overtime, I will be suing his all. And I was beside myself. And then I started rethinking, here we go again. I remember my father losing benefits when he came back from overseas.
You know, the first few days are really blurry. I remember the neurologist coming out and doing these tests, raise this arm, raise that arm, and seeing my face, and that was tough. That sucked. And then after the hospitalization, however long I was there for, I remember, you know, the doctor coming in and saying, well, you know, the evidence is inconclusive. We can't figure out what's going on. We can't figure out why this is causing, you know, what caused this. We don't have any answers for you, but unfortunately, like, we've run all the tests we can. We're going to discharge you. Like, okay. Well, I don't feel better. My head's killing me. What's going on? And they were like, yeah, here's your report. You're out of here. You got to go. So that was kind of a shock. We felt like, you know, I was with it at this point mentally, but I wasn't physically. It wasn't there. And as I tried to step out of the bed, I fell, and my dad ended up carrying me out of the VA, and he was pissed, and he was pretty vocal about it. So I was pretty disappointed at that point, and then the VA said, well, we're going to continue to see you as an outpatient, though. So you'll have to just come back every week or so until we can finally space these appointments out and continue to do MRIs and let you know, what we find as we track you. Thanks.
The VA typically is a grossly mismanaged and non-functioning organization. That's hard for me to say because they are my outlet and they are inept from the top to the bottom.
And then I got bounced between two different VA hospitals for a long time and then a third hospital eventually. And it was like started seeing all these different specialists, but there was no one doctor tracking all the care. So I just ended up getting medications from every single person I saw. And it got to the point where I was like, I'm not taking these. I had a bag full of medications at my mom's house. And I was like, if I was to take all those, I'm pretty sure I'd be dead. So I'm not going to do it.
It's not sufficient because of funding has a lot to do with it. Funding has a lot to do with it. I know John struggled coming back, seeing that struggle, what he went through, even up at UMass Amherst. John and my daughter and another vet from Afghanistan set up a group on campus to help future vets come back and to get the education they deserve. Very proud of him of that, because regardless of what he's facing at this point in his life, he's still reaching out, helping other fellow veterans. And to this day, he does a lot of speaking with my daughter, and they're raising funds. And it's a great awareness that people need to know about.
People can also have varying degrees of disability. People can have PTSD, and they're able to function, they're able to go to work, they're able to relate to their family, compared to some unfortunate people who are so preoccupied with the event and they're so hyper-aroused and have so much trouble concentrating and irritability that they're virtually 100% disabled.
The impact on my family. See, I've got a unique perspective because I was an observer of PTSD before I was a sufferer. So the impact on the family is far-reaching. Mom could not deal with my father's PTSD and the violence and the abuse in our home, so she chose to take her life over living another day with it. And between the time my mother committed suicide and my father committed suicide, I went off to war and came back with it myself. And my dad didn't know nothing about PTSD. He died before I was ever diagnosed or ever had a conversation. The closest thing to common ground that my father and I had concerning PTSD was a conversation we had sitting in his office one day. And we were actually sitting there talking about something else altogether, and I had asked him a question, and he didn't respond. So I looked at him, and I noticed he was focused on something outside the window. I adjusted and looked outside to see what he was looking at, and there was a couple of kids out there throwing a ball around, laughing, having a good time, all smiles. And my dad just said, you ever have that much fun? And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, you ever do anything that created a belly laugh or a genuine expression of enjoyment? I'd never thought of it. I had never thought of that before. And I looked out there and saw the boys and looked at my dad, and just this nausea set in. I realized, oh man, I'm wherever my dad is. I knew it, and I didn't know where that was.
Post-traumatic stress disorder wreaked havoc on the relationship that I had with my wife and my two children. My effort was to be the best man, the best father, the best husband, the best employee that I could possibly be. But not understanding, not being aware of what was affecting me, absolute havoc, total chaos. Divorce, which led to almost unrecoverable depression. And it's still playing a big part in my life right now.
Yeah, the point being that this is not just a centralized and fringe problem anymore. You know, average family is, what, five members now? in the country. You get a vet comes home with PTSD, even though he's only a member of the minority of people coming back. You've got a minimum of the veteran and the five members of that family being affected immediately.
Guilt is always a part of PTSD, whether it's combat-related PTSD or other trauma-related PTSD, whether it's the woman or man who was raped, the child who was molested. Part of them always feels as though maybe if I did something different, that wouldn't have happened to me. And that's an important thing to realize as a therapist. It's an important thing to realize as a husband, as a wife, to understand that the individual who is suffering suffers in part because of the guilt that they carry. Certainly, in some cases, it is part of the healing process to recognize that one is holding guilt for whatever reason they may be holding guilt for. That's a delicate layer to peel back, and that should be peeled back slowly.
The best questions that I ever had, or the best way that I've been treated since I've been homeless, people, especially from friends and family that knew I served, well, how are you doing? But it's not that they're not poking and prodding for like anything negative. It's not the stupid questions that you hear from people who have no idea. How many people did you kill? Wow, that must have been crazy, right? What kind of guy do you, like, who gives it? That's not, you ask those questions, but you don't really care. And you're not in tune with the person's feelings. You're not in tune with how they're living. So why ask them? Because you're going to walk away from that conversation and be like, whatever. And I got that from a lot of that from the younger crowd, especially when I first came back and went to school. But my advice to people now is, if you know they're having a tough time, surround yourself with them. You want to stay in their life. I know, my situation, my family never let me go away. They never let me kind of retreat on myself or just like lock myself away. They never gave me that option, no matter how difficult it was to deal with me. And I know it wasn't easy. No matter how fast or far I wanted to run, they'd give me my space and then they'd be right there. No matter how difficult it was, no matter how much pain I brought into the home, they always were there to just say, look, we understand it's a tough time, but we're going to be here for you. And that made a world of difference.
We had some fights. It didn't get physical. It came pretty close a few times. I didn't want to. We're both very alpha male, and I had been training for a while in MMA, and he had been training overseas, and I don't think we really wanted to see who was going to win that one. We had some screaming matches, and it got pretty heated on more than one occasion. And things that, it was different than before, I think, we had more of a older brother, younger brother dynamic before he went overseas, and then when he came back, it seemed more like we were on an even playing field. He'd grown a lot and matured quite a bit, and so, whatever we were fighting about at the time, I don't even remember, but we both felt strongly that we were right and weren't willing to bend, so.
Every time I sit down and have dinner with John, I end up with another memory. We spend a lot of time together lately, and I know things will always could only get better for him. So I'm very proud of my son, I'm proud of his service, and he has a tight family that's willing to support him for whatever he needs.
Well, it's getting better. I know he's been in treatment at Mass General, and I feel like all in all, that's been good. We've had some bumps along the way. Like recently, they put him through some therapy where they had him recalling some of the more difficult moments when he was overseas, and that was a tough time for him, where he was pretty angry, and it was just one of those things where he wasn't himself, we could all tell, and we just gave him the space he needed, and he just, you know, didn't want to talk to anybody for a little while. So I suppose, like, you know, in that sense, we're pretty understanding, and it's just something that it's just a part of it.
I think that, you know, if you have a loved one or a friend or anyone that you know of who's been deployed in a combat zone or at war, then to simply be sensitive to that and to let them know that you will listen, you know, if they want to talk about their problems. To not ask, you know, big question issues, you know, to not solicit too much, don't push too much, but simply let your husband or your boyfriend or whoever it is, or your girlfriend, know that you're there to listen when they're willing to talk about the problems that might be bothering them.
Well, there's several things you can do to educate families. One of them is to listen, is to help them to listen to their loved one who was in combat, if he or she wants to talk. In other words, not cut them off when they start talking about it, not say, oh, let's talk about something else. Oh, that's over, that's in the past, why don't you get over it now? That's one thing we can help families or friends not to do, by being willing to listen. On the other hand, some veterans just don't like talking about it, and they resent people probing into it. So it's okay to ask questions about it, but not to be too pushy. Another thing is that they can read. There are a number of publications now designed for laymen, little booklets, pamphlets, to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder and how it happens and what the symptoms are. And if they're with a professional, the professional can help to explain to them what PTSD is like. And a lot of times they will say, well, that's exactly what my husband is like. And then when they see, or sometimes a patient himself will say, well, that's exactly what I'm like. And sometimes they think they're all alone, they're the only one. But if they see that there's a diagnosis we have called PTSD, and they appreciate that there are, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who have had that, sometimes they feel better about it. They realize they're not alone.
Generally, I think I did what any sibling would do in my position, was just do everything that you can do for that person. So I didn't struggle academically the way that John had. So I signed him up for classes with me to make sure that he was checking off the requirements for his degree. I talked to him about, you know, what kind of major he would want to go into, and helped him study. I tutored him in some classes. I taught him how to study again by making note cards and by taking proper notes in class.
And I know that I was so, you know, it's like I had blinders on, like I was closed-minded. I thought I was doing okay and I could just fight through all the issues I was having. And what would have struck a chord in me, I'm not sure. But the thing that I know now that I didn't know when I first came home is that life can get so much better. Your sleep can get better. You know, your fears, your insecurities, your thoughts, I mean, they can all improve if you're willing to take that first step to get help. And I know some people aren't as fortunate to have, you know, a strong family and a really strong social network and have the connections, but, you know, reach out to people and don't be afraid to say, you know, what's out there for me? You know, like, what resources do I have, whether or not I decide to utilize them? Because you may not be ready when you first come home. And I understand that because I wasn't.
The post-traumatic stress disorder can affect anybody. And in a war, it can affect people on both sides. Nobody's exempt from getting PTSD.
I think about things from kind of the other point of view. You know, I'm sure that there is a sister sitting somewhere in the Middle East, you know, on the other side of things, who feels exactly the way that I do about my brother. And I feel terrible, you know, that somebody else has to go through this, no matter, you know, what side of any conflict they're on, because, you know, or maybe it's just, she's just the brother of somebody who was lost as a civilian, and that's terrible.
So what are the children in Iraq going to make of this? You know, what impression is going to be left in their mind about America and American soldiers and American troops? And how's that going to shape political ties in the future? I mean, I think that's a huge question. That's something that I'd like to hear about. I mean, wow.
For the good people that are in the Middle East and the people that care and the people who are just stuck in the middle of this, I mean, over here in the United States, we cry and we whine about what a terrible financial position we're in and this and that. It's nothing compared to these people that are stuck in the middle of a combat zone. It's not even close.
Because you get to looking at the stuff on the TV and you wonder, did they really even want the help? Did they really want us over there? Well, you know, bring the troops home. There's nothing else we can do for them. They don't want the help.
I mean, 10 years of war is very hard for a nation. Right now, I think that we should step back and start to withdraw, or as we withdraw the soldiers, we need to take some of that funds that we use for the war to heal ourselves as veterans, as a nation.
The main responsibility of care for veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder has to fall upon the Department of Veterans Affairs, or the VA. But that doesn't mean that other institutions can't also help out. For example, here at Massachusetts General Hospital, we have a joint venture between the Boston Red Sox and the hospital setting up a program called Home Base, which invites all veterans, regardless of their status with the VA, to come in and receive an evaluation and treatment. And this is a growing program that we're very proud of.
When a culture experiences a trauma, like 9/11 or Pearl Harbor or something like that, those are parts of our history where you might see the best in us. But those are also the parts in our history where you might experience the worst in us too.
So with regard to family members who weren't there and family members who are not knowledgeable about psychiatry, they may not understand. They may find that their husband or son or father has come back and seems to be a different person, not the same person since they were in combat, but they may not understand what happened to them. And they may not appreciate what they went through.
We are struggling for our lives. And we try very, very, very hard to fit in. And we know that we don't belong. And society lets us know that we don't belong. It's like treading water and having someone put their hand on your head and continually try to push you under. And you struggle and you fight to get your head above water, and then someone just pushes your head down again. I mean, how many times, how long can you keep that up?
Left to find